All right, Commissioner, you are on.
Right. Good morning, everyone. This is Julie Fedorchak, Commissioner at the Public Service Commission. And we are gathered here this morning for a work session on the Coyote Creek Mining Permit, case number NACC-1302. That's the permit number. Case RC-13-850. We had these hearings. When was this? Before Christmas. Right before Christmas.
Right before and right after.
Right, exactly. 3 days of hearings. And now the both the company and the appellant, or I'm not sure what you call them, filed their closing arguments. And we have those. We've got the transcript. We have late filed exhibits or some discussions that went back and forth. Proposed motions. And so we've got all the data that we need to start working through a decision here. So I guess that's the goal today, is to talk through some of the issues. And to lead that discussion, I'm going to turn it over to our portfolio holder, Randy Christman. But before I do that, I'll see if Commissioner Kalk has any opening comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick procedural question for Alana. Now, is Jim is not a commission advisor, or is he a commission advisor?
He is.
Well, I'm double sure that. Okay. I just want to make sure we had the right people at the table. I was pretty sure of that, but we had a lot of people testify. I just want to make sure that we didn't give somebody more standing, so I know I'm good.
Okay.
Commission advisors cannot augment factual record without testifying to it, but they're not advocacy staff like when we actually litigate and appoint opposing advocacy staff. They're
that
still advisors, but they
need.
No, that part didn't, but that's how the staff evidence and facts gets on the record.
Okay. Thank you, ma'am.
Okay. All right. So we have our general counsel, Alana Jeffcoat-Sacco, here, and Jim Deutsch, who is head of the Reclamation and AML Division. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Commissioner Christman.
Clearly, in the last few months, a lot of people have put a lot of work into this, starting out primarily with the transcriptionist. Put that all together, and that has to be a ton of work. I can't imagine how someone does that, but they do. And then the lawyers from both Coyote Creek and from Mr. Voigt's side have put together their documents, and a lot of good information in there, a lot of things that, you know, I recalled after reading them, but points that they brought out and emphasized that I find pretty useful. And then our staff has put together a draft document that I think does a pretty good job of summarizing the case for me. So I have some points, I guess, from all three of them that either a point that one made that the others didn't, or that I would want to challenge or what. But I don't know if – I guess I'm comfortable in kind of making our draft document be sort of a starting point to compare other things to, if the two of you are also comfortable kind of doing the work session in that way.
Sure.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, so should I just start going through the things that I wanted to emphasize and address from all three of the filings?
I think that works, Randy, and I have some questions as well that I'll just maybe see how the discussion flows, but I may just wait till the end and throw mine in, or if they're kind of related to similar things that you have.
Well, feel free to interrupt at any time, and I'll just start going through them. How's that?
Perfect.
In the Voigt closing argument on page 17, number 43, it states that the Coyote Creek mining expert, Mr. Bickle, disagrees with the key conclusion in the 2009 AVF study. And I'm thinking that I haven't had time to review the whole manuscript, but that staff needs to review that manuscript and see exactly what was said at that point, and if that is what was said and it's a key point, we need to address it in our draft.
Yeah, I guess on that, I'll guess have to go through the transcript and check that.
Okay. Jim, you might want to put your microphone a little closer. Just okay. Sometimes it's hard to pick up. If you're listening online, we want to make sure everybody can hear us.
Yeah, I do recall some discussion that some of Dr. Bickel's testimony, agreeing that there was some subirrigation right adjacent to the stream, but as far as it being extensive in enhancing alfalfa production, I don't recall that, and this may be something that...
I do think we should get it in context and make sure of what is accurate and in context and address the...
But the only thing I'd say is I wouldn't disagree with that, but you're going to have one witness who's going to say it's A. Another witness is going to say it's B. And so we make the decision which one we put more weight in. So if we start going that this person said this, then we try to counter it in our phrasings, that's not a legal doctrine. We get off what the legal basis should be. I think you're going to have witnesses testify one way, our witnesses testify the other way, the company's witnesses another way, and then we decide which is what we agree. We put that in our order. So if we get an order that Bill says 12 acres, then we try to contradict it to say it's 8 acres, that we end up going back and forth in the document instead of just drawing legal conclusions. And so there's a fine line there that I don't want to start having to... If a witness testifies to something which we know is incorrect, we correct it in a later part of the order. So I don't know if I'm explaining that correctly, Alana, but I think you know what I'm trying to get to, because we've had this discussion in other orders where a witness will say something that we know by our records is factually incorrect. We just offset it in the rights part of the order. We don't get this back and forth, the discussion in the order.
Well, yeah, I think I understand what you're saying, and I think I understand Commissioner Chrisman's concern also. I was just asking Jim to find the finding, the draft finding that talks about that issue. And what I was planning on doing was double-checking the transcript so we know exactly what we're talking about, and then double-checking that finding or two or three, however many are in there, to see if it may already be covered by how you write your finding. But right now I can't do that. But I certainly will come back with a response. I agree that I don't think the order will get into, each witness necessarily and their dispute, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. We try to avoid that. We try to reach the conclusive decision about all of that testimony. But we'll see what the language needs to be when we look at the facts a little closer.
I do think there's a distinction, though, between, a witness for one side or the other just saying what they believe to be the case, and we have to weigh things and decide how much merit or what, in fact, is the truth. But when the assertion is that a witness for one side actually said something in favor of the other side and kind of countered what they were really there to do by the people who brought them on, I think we need to give it close scrutiny.
Oh, I agree. But the way would be, I think, put it in a finding of fact, right? Isn't that what
Correct.
Okay. And it would be the finding of fact about AVF and sub-irrigation, and there may be more than one. At this point, I'm not really finding exactly what I'd do with it, but...
Correct. Just as this actually, this is only addressed in the opposing argument, not in their order.
All right. Okay.
We'll put it on our to-do list.
Okay. The next one, continuing in Mr. Broughton's closing argument, on page 20, in number 54. Even after... And this is a case maybe a little more similar where there's just point and counterpoint, but even after Mr. Deutsch's testimony, this still keeps coming up that only 1,684 acres of native grasslands have ever been released. And I don't know, in staff's draft, it does have some actual acreages, but I don't know if we want to point this out, that wherever this assertion keeps coming from, it's not what our statistics show, or if we just want to drop it. This is a case of a point counterpoint, like you were saying earlier.
That seemed like information I hadn't seen before, so maybe that in terms of the specific native grasslands, but it could be that it was, you know, there was so much information coming out, I don't recall seeing that.
I'm not sure where Mr. Broughton got that number that he put in. I think it's used in a couple places where he speaks of it's only 1,684 acres of native grassland being bond released, which is, you know, clearly not correct, you know, based on the bond releases we've had.
But that's what you have to say. The witness testified that this is what they thought, and then in our finding of fact, PSC records backed up by this, and this show this number. And then if somebody wants to parse something out of the order, that's just one of the challenges. We just have to make sure it's correct based on our records.
So I don't know if that's something we want to put in our findings, the fact that this statistic continues to be brought up, but wherever that's addressed, the actual figures kind of counter that or negate it.
Is that in the record somewhere that we could do that? Did Witness A testify this, but PSC records show that would be perfect?
He cites Exhibit 7, and I don't remember what that was, but it might have been your chart. And so we can, again, have a statement explaining the chart as Jim did on the stand. Okay. Is that what 7 was, Jim? Do you remember?
I don't remember if that was the...
Which exhibit? Us?
PSC Exhibit 7, yeah.
Okay.
That was the table that lists the...
I think so, because we didn't have too many.
The bond release by... If that's Exhibit 7, it's the table that lists the total final bond release by mine and by land use.
I must have left that one on my desk.
Yeah, and then he later cites math derived from Exhibit 8. Well, again, we'll check those, and we'll certainly put down the correct statement in wherever it's appropriately belongs.
And the last of these, and you know, this one too is probably a point counterpoint thing. But the last one, when I say that, I mean out of the Voight document. There continues to be this assertion that 35% tame grasses will be allowed. This is on page 21, number 60. And, you know, that is one of the factors, but, you know, there's also the other testimony that actually no tame grasses will be seeded, and they've developed some new strategies to try and minimize the amount of tame grasses that come on their own. And in the case of the Kentucky bluegrass, it's limited to what's in the neighboring the reserve. What are the plots that go undisturbed for sound?
The undisturbed reference areas?
The reference areas. And so this is another one of those that it sort of keeps coming up, and I don't know if we need to just ignore the fact that it's only one part of the story, or if we need to address it and point out this keeps coming up, but it's only one factor in this, and it's
I think
largely negated.
It needs to be addressed and explained. Yeah.
Okay. And then, would you like me to move on to the Coyote Creek documents, or do you want to stick with the filings from Mr. Voight's side first?
Since we're going down that path, I have a couple thoughts and questions on the Voight closing argument, so maybe I should ask mine now, too. And this is on the AVF determination piece. They spend a great deal of time talking about, you know, the lack of evidence that they feel existed to back up the AVF determination, included all of those charts and, you know, all the points where there wasn't data wasn't collected. I was on point 23. It says PSC's regulations state, it's page 7, that studies performed during the AVF investigation by the applicant must include an appropriate combination adapted to site-specific conditions of the following. And then, you know, there's a couple pages. But then they go on to say that they're just, you know, really wasn't credible evidence to support our determination. I'd be interested in having, you know, some specific note about what were the factors, if you will, the appropriate combination of factors that did support the AVF determination. And I'm not sure if that has been laid out real clearly in our draft order or not, Jim, but if you can even, I'd be interested in you kind of highlighting what those are even today, if you can.
Well, on that, I think I'll have Bruce Beachy address that, because he was the one that kind of took the lead in those AVF determinations, mm-hmm. you know, the factors. So, Bruce, if I don't know if you want to just come up to
come to a mic.
We have three up here, and they're short.
Oh, whoops, it's on. Sorry. I'll pass it to Bruce.
And, Commissioner, I hope I'm looking at the correct portion of the document that you're talking about?
Page 9, I think. Let's see.
Mine.
8, and it starts on 8.
What I have is not paginated.
There.
Oh.
I think what Bruce has is probably the recommended order from Mr. Broughton, but I think
the
table is in that as well, if I remember right, so.
So, Commissioner, you would like to kind of go through these?
Yeah, what were the key elements, the appropriate combination of conditions that led to the negative AVF determination?
Well, there's a handful of things that we need to look for in these AVF determinations. And it all deals with water resources provided to a valley. I think everybody's in agreement that Kyle Creek is a topographic valley holding a stream with stream-laid sediments. There's no question. Mm. And that covers the geology and geomorphology aspect of trying to determine an AVF. And then it starts breaking down into subsets of other resources, for example, vegetation, soils, and hydrology. And I think for soils, the soils along the valley of Coyote Creek have been identified by Mercer County as well as Coyote Creek consultants, as well as our own professional soil scientists, as straw loams, and as you move further up away from the floodplain, it turns into shamble loams, I believe, but it is determined, and NRCS documents show that straw soils are not sub irrigated soils. And they consider with straw soils that the alluvial groundwater level is 80 inches or deeper, and it would need to be shallower in order for sub irrigation to play into this.
Julie, if I remember during this part of the hearing, I asked the question about what the different soil types, and the witness didn't even understand soil types. To me, that was just like a big red flag, because what Bruce just said there, you know, we could put a finding in there that says that soil types of the region and sediments support the previous decision of alluvial valley. I mean, it just, it lays in perfectly. Mm-hmm. But their witness, they really punted that one, because what Bruce just laid out, that's the basis of the case, that all these soil types and all the way the sediments play in, it supports it's the right decision.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we want to clarify that, just what Bruce said, almost put that as a finding in there somehow, I think that would be good.
Mm-hmm.
But that to me was like, that's when I really said, okay, I think that we've got a solid case. We'd already voted on this thing. So that was a big aha moment to me, that he couldn't even walk through those soil types, because he should have been able to do just what Bruce just said and contradict it, but he couldn't.
Mm-hmm. Were there other key pieces, Bruce? I mean, the soil type sounds like it was probably the main determining factor.
Soil types is huge. Another thing, of course, is hydrology. Because determination of AVF and what really are true AVFs has got everything to do with water resources, and either through flood irrigation or sub-irrigation, and the complainants hammered pretty hard on sub-irrigation, and the information that we have regarding water levels in the alluvial aquifer, which would be the soils beneath the croplands and the hayland tracts there, our information from the landowner himself to Mr. Greg Smeestead, who was the consultant putting the 2009 package together for the Dakota Westmoreland Corporation, said when asked the water levels in his wells. He's got two wells, both in alluvium, varied between 18 and 20 feet below surface. And also we've got they also provided the information in the 2009 report, and we cross-checked that regarding water levels that were taken by State Water Commission and USGS in a county groundwater report called Oliver Mercer Geology and Groundwater Resources Report, and water levels of those two wells were also reported between 16 and 18 or 16 and 20 feet. So, in other words, we're looking at water levels 16 to 20 feet below surface at least, although more recent water level information from Kyle Creek, where their particular monitoring wells are located, show closer to about 10 feet now. And OSM guidelines, 1983, I think that was provided as evidence, shows average rooting depth of alfalfa to be 5 feet. In addition to NDSU Extension Service, average rooting depth of alfalfa is 5 feet in North Dakota.
So is the alfalfa a poor crop to use for determining an AVF because it roots so deep?
I think that's one of the crops that they recommend being used, that can be an indicator that in a lot of the areas, it's the enhanced hay production that ends up making areas being identified as AVF, and alfalfa is oftentimes the crop being grown that where you do get the added benefit of sub-irrigation. But in this case here, I think, again, the depth of water is depth of groundwater is too deep to enhance hay production. Some of the alfalfa, where it's, you know, the typical go down maybe 10, 12, 15 feet, maybe even beyond that. But there again, though, so few roots that the plant maybe is able to survive, but it doesn't provide enough water for enhanced hay production.
Mm-hmm.
OSM guidelines in several places points out that for true sub-irrigation in the AVF concept needs to do more than just maintain plant life. It needs to increase productivity, like Jim just said.
Okay, so that's a key factor, is the increased productivity.
Yes.
And is that where then, when you get into some of the other arguments on Voight's closing arguments, where they get into, you know, the PSC should have, now we need to consider the new evidence that they're offering, and they point to the production records and the infrared photos. So were those considered the first time around? We didn't have the production records, but the infrared photos, was that, I didn't necessarily view that as new information in this hearing because it was in the record. You've had those, you know, going back to when they were first taken.
You have your affidavit.
The 1978 infrared photos referred to then that were added as a late file exhibit serve the basis of areas identified in the OSM reconnaissance mapping of AVFs in North Dakota that those were used there. And from that standpoint, they were indirectly used. But I think from what Bruce has said before, that those infrared photos were not used back in 2009.
The basis, yeah.
Yeah, wasn't the direct basis for it, but in reviewing there is in the field as potential AVFs, it was, you know, this document here was used, the maps,
sure,
maps in there that
because what OSM did, based on the actual aerial infrared photos, they took that information and they transposed it onto maps that we do look at. And it outlines areas that could potentially be flood irrigable or sub-irrigated, meaning potential AVF. And we don't concentrate our AVF reviews on just those areas that OSM thinks could be potential. We require the applicant to review and discuss all of the drainages within a particular area, not just those areas that OSM felt back in 1978 was potential AVF, but all of them. And we did look at those maps. Yes, we did.
Mm-hmm.
How do you encapsulate all that stuff? I think that's maybe it's a great point you're on, Commissioner. All the stuff you're saying is all what you've done. How does that get viewed if it in the record? Well, that's more of a legal thing. All this stuff is the basis of what they did. Now, if this gets looked at by another body, how do they know all that?
Well, we're going back to the my note to Jim. We're going back with this recording and the transcript and the affidavits and making sure that what everything we're talking about now factual is in our existing record. And
it's
if it isn't, we're asking to put it in because it cannot be used by the commission. And I'm remembering what Bruce said. And if he said it in a different way, that's fine. If he added any facts that aren't there, then we will move to bring them before the commission.
But there's nothing that I've heard today that Bruce said that wasn't said in the stand.
Right. Well, that's what I'm thinking, but we're going to be very careful.
But you're saying, though, it doesn't necessarily need to be highlighted in the order as long as we have it in our record.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. You'll explain your conclusion if you conclude that there's no alluvial valley floor. You will simply explain what you base that conclusion on, and you will not repeat everything. I was going to ask if you're looking at, and I was trying to tick off the kinds of things in this list in the rules of what you're supposed to be looking at on page 8 when you conclude. This is what Commissioner Vodarczyk, you started your question with, right? I will note that it says that the PSC's regulations say that it must include, but that it must include an appropriate combination adapted to site-specific conditions. And so to me, that means you will not necessarily do every one of these things every time.
Right.
And I think, if I'm not mistaken, Bruce, they questioned you about this on the stand, the same list in the rules, if I recall correctly, and you explained the parts of it you did and didn't do and why. Am I remembering the record correctly here?
Well, I think so. And some of this, for example, I just saw it here a minute ago. Soil modeling, we definitely did that. We dug half a dozen holes on the Section 19 and 30 cropland tract. For example, one of the things that we did not do is rooting depth, measurement of rooting depth. And in order to correctly do that requires the use of an excavator or a backhoe. And that was done one time in North Dakota early on, back in the early 1980s, I believe. And OSM, in particular, in several places in the guidelines, says that for these AVF investigations, applicant or the person that is putting this document together for our review need only use readily available or easily obtainable information available in the public domain. And if there was a question that came up, if we were borderline ourselves on trying to determine whether this area is AVF or not, then we could require the mining company or their consultant or whoever is putting that package together to take some of these more extreme measures to fine-tune the information provided to determine whether AVF is whether this would be an AVF or not.
Okay. I can talk about another point that they make. There's a fair amount of discussion about the presence of water. I'm forgetting where it was now on which page here, but the presence of water, I think the presence of water that could be used for enhanced egg production, and I'm oversimplifying, but I think their main point was just the fact that if you can confirm that there's a presence of a water and there's enough of it to support irrigation, then it should be an AVF.
And I think I think what you're talking about is where they've kind of moved the discussion from sub-irrigation to flood irrigation.
Right.
A significant amount or enough water in Coyote Creek.
I guess I have a concern there because I thought during the hearing that there wasn't much discussion about the flood irrigation, the surface irrigation at all. So in the closing argument, that it seemed like they brought in new stuff in that closing argument. And where do we go with that? I guess that's a question for Alana. Legally, if they are bringing new things into the closing argument, which I thought was the case, it's
not allowed. Yeah, I mean, it's not allowed to be used to make a decision unless, is there anything?
But Alana, there's reams of information that was added to the record that probably is in there someplace.
Well, that's what I was just going to ask. It's reams, but it's it seems like reams, I understand. But it really was just all about the last memo. Those last three things that were, that they realized at the hearing you had. And so if it's in there, it's part of the record. But if there's flood irrigation facts and stuff in
I guess with regard to, flood irrigation, there's discussion in the OSM guidelines.
Yes.
In that, but as far as that being specifically being raised and discussed with regard to Coyote Creek, that was, if was touched on, it was real briefly.
Real brief.
Not to the extent that it is in the closing argument.
Right. And the closing arguments, it's free game to try to say whatever you want to say. It's not evidence. It's argument.
Well, then if we're going to respond to that, to counter some of that, what latitude do we have
Here's the way a court would do it, I think. An appellate court would say, A, you'd go back and make sure how much is really in the record. Okay, if there's a trickle, one little comment of some sort, you'd say, that's not enough. That's not sufficient to support what you're saying you want me to put in this order. And then you'd say, B, so you'd say it's an irrelevant thing. It's not going to be addressed. But even if it was going to be addressed, here's the answer. Now, that's dicta, but so it's not something, a foundation of the decision, but it's in there to answer the question. And so we can work on that. These questions, there's several of them that are going to take some real close scrutiny of the transcript, which we will do together, and we'll make sure.
But there's also that point of where people put nonsense in orders just to put nonsense in orders.
Yes.
We have a responsibility to make an order that supports our decision, that's clean, that's backed up, that you don't want to get off on all these tangents that really don't come back to what your decision needs to be. And so just walking that fine line, I think, is still, if somebody puts nonsense in an order, we don't have to address it in our order.
No, we don't. And we could do something as simple as there's insufficient evidence, the flood irrigation meaning anything. I mean, you could have one line that addresses six pages of their argument, but it's saying there's nothing in this transcript to show flood irrigation means AVF or whatever the sentence turns out to be. But what we want to do is double check it with the actual record. And I had the same question about whether those late filed exhibits had much information in them about this, but I don't recall that they did.
I don't think about flood irrigation, not that I recall.
Okay. Well, I regret that I can't find this now, but there was one section in here that specifically references the Dakota Westmoreland, the 2009 AVF study.
Okay.
And pulls from that cites the water quantity data included in that, which is clearly part of the record. Whether they talked about it or not, does that matter if they didn't highlight this during the hearing?
No, it's part of the record.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why when it comes in late, you can use it. It's a late exhibit.
This wasn't late, though. This was right during the hearing, this deal.
Right. One of them.
Right, number three.
One of the reports was in, and one was not in until later.
Okay.
I don't remember which is which.
We spent a fair amount of time going through this during the hearing. But they talk about the water quantity being sufficient enough to support irrigation, and then they kind of cite this as their factual basis for saying that. And I guess my question to you guys is, you know, is just the presence of water enough, or do we have to, do you use some other factors, like I'm looking at the beginning of this document, the same AVF determination where you talk about, you know, the capability of an area to be flood irrigated based on evaluations of typical regional agriculture practices plus the water quality. So my understanding is that there isn't much irrigation occurring there. So can you was that part of your determination that maybe there was enough water if you were to set up some irrigation systems, but those don't exist, so it isn't contributing to,
I think,
enhanced production?
I think based on some of the hydrology that has come forward here, I think there would be a reasonable amount of water or volume of water for 100 and some acres of worth of irrigation. So I think the volume of water, I don't think that would be an issue other than some other, downstream interests that may be using Coyote Creek water for livestock watering or whatever. Water quality is an issue. We do know that the electrical conductivity or the soluble salt content in the water is high. The U.S. Salinity Lab developed a table and based potential for agriculture on two things, sodium content and salt content. And both are listed in low, medium, high, very high. And the salt content of the water in Coyote Creek and in the alluvium is in that high to very high category. Generally speaking, I think it probably could be used for irrigation, but with significant management, and I think most people would be advised to not use that water for irrigation. There's one other thing, and all these AVF reports, and we require them to dig into this too, is looking at the past history of irrigation in the Stream Valley and in similar stream valleys, current irrigation practices, and any potential for future irrigation practices. And there's none of those in Coyote Creek Valley. And OSM, and I could pull out the quote there. It's in the 1983 or the 85, but they basically state that if irrigation practices in this valley and in similar valleys or drainages, if irrigation is not being practiced, then it's not considered a regional practice and should not be considered for AVF based on flood irrigation.
Okay.
It's very pointed, and it's in the guidelines.
Well, they seem to put a lot of weight on the fact that it could be, you know, could be used. And from what I hear you saying, that OSM doesn't leave it at that. And that's not the final determination that it could be. It's just, is it a practice in that area? And is it contributing a lot to the viability of the ag region?
OSM recognized that in the study area, which included all of the coal mining areas in North Dakota, is about four different study areas that were included in this flyover and in this AVF investigation, that there were 11 farms or areas that did practice flood irrigation, and even based on that, they said because of the minimal use of flood irrigation in the area, it is not considered a regional practice, and for that reason alone, they eliminated a huge stretch of Knife River, even though within that stretch of Knife River there is flood irrigation being practiced.
Okay. Then I just want to talk for a minute about the production records, because that was some new evidence that they said the PSC must consider, and so I know what I heard about that, but I guess I'd be interested in you guys walking through what you heard and how that affects or doesn't affect an AVF determination in terms of the production records that were supplied at the hearings.
Well, I think on that, I was thinking that in Sarah Flass' testimony that she discussed that quite a bit. It was those production records that Casey Voigt came in and offered as an exhibit, and with regard to those, she found that there was the production records from some of the upland areas as well as some of the areas along Coyote Creek, and based on the soils in the different areas that she felt there should have been higher production off of the straw soils and those hay fields along Coyote Creek compared to the upland areas.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the straw soils, what was mentioned before, that it's on the record that is a highly productive soil, and that produces well as you get up to some of the upland areas. I don't know if there's anything on the record as far as what those soils were, but there again, they were not as productive as those straw soils, and looking at the production in some of those years, that it seemed like the straw soils on the alluvium should have been higher than the upland areas. Well, again, the absolute production was higher, but when you look at what the soils were, and I forget what the percentages were right now, but it should have been higher, and had there been sub-irrigation present on the straw soils, there should have been better yields than what there were.
So I know that was Sarah's conclusion. She represents or works for the company. Is that your guys' independent conclusion, too? You agree with that from a scientific standpoint?
In looking at that, and when we were discussing this at staff level, we agreed with that.
Okay. That they, just so I'm understanding, the soil type alone would account for some increased production, but even just the differences in the soil type itself, the lower fields didn't perform as well as you'd expected, just based on soil type, not even considering any additional water resource. Soil type alone, you would have expected the production on the lower fields to be even higher than it was.
In comparing the two.
And that's not even taking into consideration any additional water from sub-irrigation. So if there were sub-irrigation, you'd expect it to be even higher yet, the production on the lower fields.
Well, if there would have been sub-irrigation, those yield numbers would have been different, where you would have had higher yields yet from the straw soils on the alluvium.
All right. Then I'm not sure where this fits, if it's now or down the road, but I guess I'll just ask it now because this became evident on the third day of the hearing. Bruce, I think you were the person on the stand when this was discussed, but that this area that is being analyzed for the AVF is not an area where there's any active mining going to occur in this permit. And so at first I had to wonder why we had spent so much time even talking about it, because there's no mining there. Then I realized that the voids are probably, their point is that the hydrology is going to be, they are concerned that the hydrology might be affected by the mining that would affect the drainage into this area. So obviously you guys considered that in issuing the permit, but I don't remember us walking through, I don't know that I asked that question then, but walk through whether that's, is or isn't a concern on this permit, whether the hydrology feeding into this river.
Is that a totally new kind of question, or was there other evidence? Because if it is, we probably should just ask all parties to respond, in a form of a letter, including staff. Yeah.
That's not totally new. Okay. We talked about that, about how the relation with the different parts and the groundwater flow, that was heavily set up the first 2 days. That's not new.
One thing I want to mention as far as, when the AVF determination was made, for Coyote Creek, the portion that runs through Casey Voigt's property there through his hay fields, that at that point we didn't even know that there was going to be a consideration of mining at Coyote Creek.
Right.
So that didn't enter the AVF determination at all. So I think I'm a little concerned going into that, too, that we're basically getting into new ground and, we're going to have to reopen the hearing if we start doing that.
It's new ground in the sense of a professional opinion about the consequence. I mean, topic is sort of covered, as Jim
said. You mentioned it. That's enough then. You didn't know exactly where there was or wasn't going to be mining, and you just considered it as if there were to be, correct?
Mm-hmm. Well, we're looking at the time of the AVF determination to see if it met the definition of AVF, if there was the enhanced production there, and there again, the concern on that first determination related to the Dakota Westmoreland mining off to the east, not mm-hmm. not anything that Cuyahoga Creek came in with. So that was completely independent, just looking at the facts of the matter. Is this an AVF or not?
Okay. All right. I think that's my main questions with this, their closing arguments.
Did you have anything on
not that we had... No, not that we hadn't already addressed. I thought it was good.
Can you jump to Cuyahoga Creek and instead of taking these in order, since you spent quite a bit of time on the ABF part, can you jump further back to the
okay.
ABF and just get those out of the way? I see them. I think there's only two points on that subject.
I didn't remember. I'd shut my mic off. So I'm jumping toward the back just to keep on the subject of AVF determinations. In the Cuyahoga Creek closing argument, on page 11, they point out that Mr. Voigt's witness, Mr. Norris, the AVF expert, did not visit the site and did not provide a report. I didn't see that point in the draft document from staff. I thought it's an important point.
There's certainly enough evidence on that in the record.
No, that's a great
point.
So
we can add it.
I remember asking him that question. The setup was something like, what do you think is more, which is better, walking the ground or, you know, mm-hmm. looking at just aerial? And he said, absolutely walking the ground. And have you ever walked the ground? Well, no. So it just led credence that Bruce's determination would be much better than someone that hadn't done that. That's a great point, Randy.
And then in Cuyahoga Creek's findings of fact... on page 12, number 29, they point out that Mr. Voigt did not request that the permit issued to Cuyahoga Creek Mining Company be suspended or revoked. And if, in fact, there were an AVF, it would have to be, right? So...
Say that again, Randy?
Yeah.
The AVF would, if we determine that there's an AVF there, we wouldn't have the permit there, correct?
Right, till we reissued it. I mean, with some other conditions or whatever.
No, not necessarily. I'm understanding the question correctly, even if this drainage, even if Cuyahoga Creek was determined by us to be an alluvial valley floor, mining would still be allowed.
Okay.
It definitely would. There is another level of information required and monitoring required in the valley floor in an effort to make sure that the mining process is not going to affect, for example, more than anything, groundwater that could flow into the alluvial aquifer. Basically, we've got that in our
I guess then I was putting a little more into this point than what there is, but
well,
it is maybe still a point that has merit to add.
Part of the protections if there is an AVF that says there's a provision about not interrupting the farming activities, but then you have to preserve the essential hydrologic functions.
Right. But this question, I think, is about them not asking for that in the beginning. Like, in the meantime, letting the permit continue in existence in the meantime until the commission makes some kind of decision, which has really nothing to do with anything.
So then I'm going to just jump to the beginning of my thoughts on Cuyahoga Creek's filings. And now the rest of these more have to do with the reclamation side of things. But in their closing argument on page 4, it states to the effect that Mr. Voigt's witness, Mr. Anderson, acknowledged that some of the Voigt land in its current condition would not meet the PSC standards for reclaimed land. And, you know, sometimes the whole gist of the case, I think, hinges on the reclamation side of it, not the AVF side, but it hinges on the quality of the reclaimed land compared to what's there now. And, you know, so, yeah, you might find something that's less desirable, but there's some things that are more desirable too. And so I thought that was an important point that we could potentially be adding to our draft.
And do you and which point on page four? I mean, I understand the general concept, but do you have certain language or?
The last paragraph, the first sentence, although Mr. Anderson testified that he felt the revegetation standards were too low to ensure Mr. Voigt would get back what he currently has, he also testified that some of Mr. Voigt's rangeland wouldn't be able to meet the standards because they're too high. And that's one, I suppose, we would need to review the transcripts. I think that was talked about.
In fact, we'd have to review the data that was collected to make sure that's an accurate statement. I guess just because it's said in here, I'm not sure that it's.
Maybe we just want to leave it.
Because you could meet the standard. You don't know it's.
Well, you don't. That's the point is that's a future thing that will eventually be. It will never be lower because you won't let them be lower, and it could be higher.
Okay.
They were making the point that his current stuff couldn't meet it.
Right. But.
That's different tracks, and you know, look at the sampling data, then basically apply our reclamation success standards to that to see if there's enough natives and high enough percentages to meet that. It probably wouldn't be real hard to do, but it's something that I think we'd want to do that before putting.
You could narrow it down, though. You could just say that he testified his land currently wouldn't meet the standards. Period. Don't try to go into the future. Just make a reference.
Put a statement like that.
If you want that.
In the interest of timeline, I mean, I don't want this to take all summer either, you know, so if maybe it's not an important enough
detail. It can't take all summer. We have a deadline. Yeah. We are going to be doing nothing else but this for a few days.
Well, I'll leave it up to your judgment whether it needs inclusion. Another point in here on the next page, on page 5, Ms. Flath points out that only native species will be planted. And I kind of addressed that earlier in countering what was in the previous statement. But and also that the seed mix is developed in consultation with NRCS and USDA. And I think that's an important point to have in our findings. On the next page, on page 6, this is again Ms. Flath. And this is another one of those where sometimes something is actually better than before. She testified that in order to meet the PSC standards for subsoil and topsoil, the Coyote Creek Mine will actually have to salvage additional material for on the Voigt land. There's not a lot of these. They just seem close together here. So it's not an indefinite list. But still on page 6, Mr. Voigt's witness, Dr. Merrill, testified that I'm not sure if it says what study he was referencing at the time, but 20 years after reclamation, there was a large improvement in soil health. And so that would be one. I don't think there's enough here necessarily to use it, but in checking the transcript, if that's accurate and we know what study that was, I think that's a pretty important point.
I think in staff's order, we do have on number 18 statement similar to that.
Mm-hmm.
Randy, so.
Oh, maybe I missed that one. 18, you said?
Yep.
I hate to acknowledge this, but I even have that highlighted. Oops. Okay. And my last thing that I wanted to point out in the Coyote Creek documents, and this is in the findings of fact, though. I don't know if I have page or... It's item 10 on page 5. In our draft, do we point out, you know, that the Voits were represented by legal counsel when they negotiated and signed the lease?
Yeah, we do.
Yeah,
is that in there?
Yep.
Okay. Okay, then I didn't have anything else to bring up out of the Coyote Creek filings.
Okay. I have, let me just go through my notes here. Okay, there was one point where on page 13 of their closing argument, Coyote Creek's closing argument, they said, Mr. Voit did not object to the 2009 Dakota Westmoreland AVF report or the Reclamation Division determination of no AVF. Thus, he's now precluded from challenging these findings. So help me understand from a process standpoint, why would he have objected to those?
I don't think he would have had the opportunity to, so I guess I would.
So that's not, doesn't have merit, that point?
Well, I would.
What page are you reading from?
13, okay. Coyote Creek closing argument.
Closing argument, okay, I have to skip around.
I guess the only chance you would have to object on that was when Dakota Westmoreland filed the revision application. Had he came in and reviewed what was in there and objected, but at that point, I don't think he...
Was it on his land?
I don't know that.
It was just
that
adjacent?
The area that was being added to the Westmoreland permit was not on his land, so...
Okay, so the suggestion here is that if he was... He should have been paying attention to that, and.
Well, you publish. I mean, for all of these things, don't you? I mean.
Well, for the AVF determinations,
no,
those are
mean,
not. But when the Westmoreland application was filed, there was notice published in the newspaper as well as we sent notices, certified mail to the landowners in there being added to the permit. But
yeah.
But I'm. Yeah, I'm almost sure that Mr. Voit was not one of those. So.
Okay. But if he was following this issue and concerned about it, the theory is he would have paid attention and commented then?
It's objected. Their theory. I mean, I don't know that this is important to this.
Yeah.
At that time, I don't think what was going on at Westmoreland was any concern of his, is
right.
My guess. So.
I think most landowners like that consider themselves involved in it when somebody's there trying to lease their land or they have leased it and it's been permitted in. I don't know either that he would really have, I suppose he could have, but I don't know that it would be reasonable to expect him to have.
Right. But it isn't a central point that you...
No, but they're saying that he's precluded from challenging these findings now, and they're challenging the findings. So, I mean...
Yeah.
Okay. So I just wanted to make sure if there was an opportunity that I wasn't aware of for doing that type of thing. But the AVF determinations, those aren't published, and you know.
No.
Okay. Okay. And then I was in the page 15 where they talk about the. This is some of the production records relating to what Ms. Flath would have predicted. Based upon the data submitted by Mr. Voigt, she noted the increasing yields from the lowlands to the uplands is only 47% compared to the 76% which would be expected. Tell me where that 76% is. What's the reference to that? Where does that come from?
That goes back to the soils that are present and what was considered the production indices for the various soil types.
Okay.
Just looking at what the rating was on the straw soil compared to the soils on those upland areas.
All right, so those are the figures we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay. I think that's all my questions on that document.
Okay. Did you have anything, Brian? Did you
no.
want to? Okay. I have just a few things on our staff draft. So starting on page 3, number 2, just kind of just covering some points of Mr. Voigt's testimony, and it's mostly about how his soil is going to be handled, and I think you would read into it, you know, looking toward the future of reclamation. And then just the last 5 words, adding the road closures and mine signage, and I remember that he brought that up, but I don't recall that it was really addressed in great detail further on in the case. The mines, if I'm correct here, the mine signage is going to be what it's going to be, and if they don't have it up correctly, will issue an NOV or something, but they have to do what the rules require, and the road closures are a county issue, aren't they?
They are. The road issues are counties, and our rules contain particular specific requirements for some of the signage and that, and from what I recall, that Casey was concerned about the no trespassing language that was put on the sign, and that. And there again, that's something. If they chose to go beyond what the rules say in doing that, it's not an issue. But I think it was that issue was discussed where they were going to remove that or do something with that. It's something that it didn't relate to our regulatory requirements. So,
well, I guess I'm not so sure on the mine signage whether it should be included here or not, but I really think the road closures especially, it just isn't our area, is it?
If you're just summarizing, which is what I see, what he said, you're summarizing at this stage, you know, what he got up and kind of told you was bothering him. I think it might be more like it might imply misleading to leave some of it out, like you didn't hear what he said, everything he said, and maybe you didn't hear a really important other thing. We'll see if later on there should be a one line that.
Okay. Well, I don't find it harmful either, but
we've marked it. I've noted it.
Well, that kind of goes back to some of your conclusions. And one of them you drew that, you know, we have no jurisdiction on leasing.
Yeah.
Same kind of thing. He testified, but you could put something similar to like that we don't do road closures.
Yeah.
Because that makes sense.
Okay. I think at that point you'd probably leave in the more thorough summary of what he said.
Okay. And then I'm jumping to page 5, number 16. And this gets back to, you know, some of the testimony earlier about how little reclamation has been done. And Mr. Deutsch brings in the statistics here, how much has been released over the years, how much of that is cropland, how much of that is native grassland, and how much of that is reclaimed hayland. But we're leaving out, if you add those up, there's like half of it that's not acknowledged. And so I think we should just add a sentence and clarify that the remainder of this is was never disturbed, or it's an industrial, or I don't think we need a lot of detail, but just something to close the loop on that. As I read it, I feel like I'm missing something. And then on page 10, number 41, and I remember this discussion in the hearing, and then I hadn't thought about it too much until I read this. I think it's a point that has really a lot of merit in that whole discussion on the hayland that, you know, A, it's not going to get mined other than the Hall Road, but the reason for it being that the coal is actually at a higher level and not down below that. But I look at this, and as I read this sentence or these sentences in number 41, I would take this to mean like you have either the water level in the creek, or maybe the floor of the creek, or something kind of creek level, and then there's 75 feet of additional elevation to where the coal is, and then there's the overburden and topsoil above that. And if we double check it and those are the numbers, then I'm fine with it. But it doesn't seem to me those hills are that high. So I just want to make sure we have our statistics right or are explaining this right.
Which number is this, Randy?
Number 41.
That's the basis of 75. What's the difference?
Yeah. I would read that to mean the coal seam is 75 higher feet higher than the creek level. And they're big hills, but I don't know. I just want to make sure we have our statistics right.
Noted.
I don't have anything else that I have to discuss.
I don't have anything more right now, but I haven't pored over the draft statement with a critical eye, our findings of fact, conclusions, law and order. I mostly was wanting to get my head around and have a discussion about some of the points that were brought up by both parties and, you know, their legitimacy and grounding and stuff. So I'll focus more on this for our next work session, which I think is next Tuesday.
Yeah, there's quite a bit of, based on all the notes, there'll be
right.
Some, quite a bit.
My first, just from a structure standpoint, I would rather break this apart and have some headings.
Yeah. There's
so that there's, you know, it's easy because there's some big issues, the AVF determination. There's some of the reclamation issues. So I'd see dividing our final order into findings of fact on those, each, you know, kind of separated. And so just from a structural standpoint, all the data might not change that much, but that's just the editor in me.
Well, there's other format changes that will be made, too, to make it more like all the other orders. So, but then in addition, there's all the notes we took. So
right. But you guys did a great job of getting through all of the volumes of information and trying to zero in on the key issues. So thanks for that.
I just had a couple, if that's all right. Jim, the only thing I had a question on is at the very end of the order, when you order detailed methods for minimizing compaction, those last three statements, I don't disagree with any of that. But is that something that can go somewhere else than just the order part of it? It seems like that's more appropriate for a different thing. Like, you know, we do pipelines, we have them do a certificate of what they're going to do. Usually the order is just a statement that's pretty clean. Is there a reason why that would be there instead of somewhere else in the order?
Well, okay. The basis for it will be in the findings. But if the permit has conditions on it, so to speak, like, and I don't really remember what they look like, and it's changing, then you'd have to put it here because that's what you're changing from that first one in October.
Okay, so that's the, but in the, didn't we address how they do compaction in the, back in October? there would have been a standard procedure for. So that's what I'm trying to get. I'm sure we addressed compaction in the first order.
Well, in the permit approval document, it addresses how the soil is going to be handled, but compaction is not specifically addressed. And I guess this is where.
So you'd be adding this.
What we'd be recommending here is to add this.
Okay, and that's how we'll kind of word it. I mean, we will. That's one of the other places that the format would change a little bit. The approval would be number one, and then there might be additional conditions to the permit or something. I don't know. I'd have to go back and look.
Is there a generally accepted practice that you would hold them to, or something that OSM has spoken on this?
Well, there's some different options. I guess we'd let them come up with what they feel would be the most appropriate, I guess, to give, basically, would have them add a section to say how they plan on dealing with, rather be with using subsoil or whatever. So,
and then the last one about, isn't it common practice that they consult with landowners when picking the final vegetation mix?
Well, they consult with landowners as far as for a post-mining land use preference, and sometimes they'll specify seed mixtures, but in this case, it's with the concern that Casey had, we're recommending that he be involved in actual selecting these undisturbed reference areas that are going to be used at the time of final bond release, for basically as a comparison, so that he's satisfied that it would adequately represent the conditions on his.
What if he's not the landowner when it comes time for this? What if he sells his land?
Well, if it's sold land, if he's not there, then it wouldn't be applicable. So
do we have to put that in there, or is that just implied?
I think that would be implied.
Okay.
I think it's probably implied, but I'll think about it.
Okay.
More.
No, I think it's good, and I appreciate this the third version. But for me, I think that we do a lot of complicated orders at the PSC, and I know you guys got a lot going on. But we got a meeting next week. If we can get a draft out, maybe we can even vote in this bugger. I don't see anything functional that holds me up from a vote on this.
That's my thought too, but that's also my question. This is a lot of work for staff, and
we have a lot of homework to do to incorporate the comments, and most people aren't here tomorrow. Right? Tomorrow's Friday. Yeah. But we will
be. Would it be reasonable to just, because the agenda comes out today.
Right.
Would it be reasonable to add it, but with the understanding that if we're unable to complete it, or if we run into big issues next Tuesday at our work session, that we will just agree that we're just going to remove it then?
Or we could go the other way, Commissioner.
What's our agenda? What's our deadline?
Well, our deadline's the 20th.
Yeah.
Okay. Personally, I don't want to rush this because it needs to be, really carefully crafted and legally defensible.
I was going to say, and based on we have the meeting next Wednesday, the 8th, and the other one's not for, next one, schedule is not for 3 weeks, so that we would have to look at a special
meeting. Right. But that's doable, I think.
Yeah, that's doable.
So I guess,
I'm supportive of that approach. I think the biggest issue for me was the AVF determination and going through what was involved in that and confirming that I felt like everything was done appropriately, and I've read all the documents, and I do feel that way. I'm on board with that, and I like that staff has incorporated some additional findings for or additional requirements for some of the reclamation issues. I want to pour over those a little bit more in detail, but I really want you guys to take the time you need to do this.
Why don't we?
Well, how about this?
We don't have to add it to the agenda. We can add it to the agenda on Wednesday morning.
It's except I kind of don't like the feel of that this got added an hour before and people didn't know it was coming on then. Sure. I would really prefer, I was just going to check, what time is our work session on this on Tuesday? That's the
11.
Before it's 9 to 11. So we'll know by noon already. How about if I put it on the agenda and people who are interested can plan for that, But we're basically announcing it now. You might want to check our agenda sometime shortly afternoon on Tuesday, because it might have been removed. And at least we're not adding it quickly. If we change it, we're removing it and putting
it on. I almost go the other way, Commissioner. I would just as soon. I don't like removing stuff from agenda. Then that story gets out there. The commissioner moved this, and then somebody will fill in the details like we didn't like something. When we're more of just a review process. Maybe we schedule a special meeting on Tuesday after the work session for Thursday or Friday to kind of find that common ground. We're not adding something late or removing something late. Because we remove stuff from an agenda for just the administrative, and it's sent the wrong, people have misinterpreted that the wrong way, too.
Jim, do you feel like you can get this thing buttoned up by Tuesday?
I guess I'm not sure. I'm planning to take at least part of Monday off, but I plan to come in tomorrow to work on this. So.
Mm-hmm.
It's your portfolio, Commissioner. I'll do whatever you decide. I'll support.
Do you have feelings on the different? I get Brian's point about it. It might not look good removing it.
Same, you can't win
it. It looks worse adding it at the last minute.
I'm hearing from staff that they don't think they can get it done.
I don't think we can get
Wednesday
it done.
And do it justice. So that's
if that's the way you're leaning.
Yes.
We'll leave it off. But I'm just announcing now. If this goes a little quicker than thought, and we are able to add it. Our guests that are here, as well as those that are listening, just know that if we have this done and it's just a matter of a couple I's to dot or T's to cross after that work session on Tuesday, we're going to add it. And so this could potentially be on Wednesday's docket.
Thank you.
And then on Tuesday, if we feel we won't be ready for the vote Wednesday, could we set the special meeting that day?
Schedule one,
yeah.
I think.
Yes.
Because I'm just
if it's clear to us about how long it'll take at that point.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Does anyone have any closing thoughts that haven't already been spoken?
My only one is, and I'd express this to Jim personally, but not to the staff. I really thought that they put together a great starting point here. You know, we can find the little things to nick at. This order has this and this one has that or something. But I am really grateful that we had this good of a starting point to compare to, that we're able to just almost copy and paste some things, and that the basis of it is, I just think, outstanding work.
Agreed. Okay, this work session is over.